We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. This is a recent broadcast of a Twitter Spaces event that we hosted. If you'd like to be a part of the next one, please follow us on Twitter, at Palisades Radio. Please note, Twitter had a lot of technical issues with this space, so the last half of the conversation, unfortunately, was lost. A big thanks to Bob, Vince, and Jim for all of their input. What follows is the first hour of the conversation. Please enjoy.
Well, we might as well get rolling here. Welcome, guys. I'm sure there's going to be lots more people rolling in here. I think we can start by laying out more so. Let's just start with, you know, some of the stuff that we covered or that you wanted to cover, Bob, what you're seeing in physical premiums and why that is such a development in the industry at this point when you would think that there would be lots of demand, lots of people jumping in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, a good place to start. I guess if we have more than 40 people listening, we're maybe at the top of the market. So as long as we stay under 40, I think we're in good shape. I think the state of the industry right now, and you've been seeing it, is this rally has been sold on by the retail public, not necessarily believed in, fought along the way. What's been the savior of the industry has been basically larger investors that, you know, maybe they're first time buyers, maybe they haven't bought in a while, or they just have a very small allocation to the metals and they're just taking another small portion of their portfolio and they're saying, okay, time to finally, the metals look like they finally woken up, you know, it's got me off the couch, it's time to allocate a little bit more capital. And I think that's initially what we've been seeing the last month, or maybe even just the last probably 2-3 weeks, is that some of these bigger players coming and buying is helping the dealers potentially offload or offset some of the retail selling that they see coming in. You know, people that have been in the markets for 15 years or for 5 years and just disappointed. And, you know, they're just saying, I can make money elsewhere. The metals are finally got up to a point where I can break even, or I've made money. I'm just going to walk away. I'm not going to wait another 15 years. They've just been distraught in the asset class. And that's been seen in a lot of sentiment measures that I try to put out and others have put out as well, especially in going into February. It was just brutal. You read on Twitter. I don't think there was a positive comment out there. I mean, when I made that comment, I think mid-February, I was talking about the mother of all short squeezes potentially happening. I mean, it was just dark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could cut that sentiment with a knife in terms of that negativity.
To your point, Bob, sorry to interrupt. To your point, though, you know, there's people within the industry. I was speaking with somebody the other day that was asking me, well, do you believe that this rally is going to last? Even people within the industry are doubting it. You know, we've made new highs for, I think it's what, 8 days in a row now, new all-time highs. So I can totally understand people's sentiment and people kind of doubting what this rally holds, because it has taken so long to get to this point, right?
Well, yeah. And what's been frustrating, I think, is people are saying, well, what's different now than it was back in 2020, 2021, 2022, when you had, you know, more events happening, you've had more retail buying and coming into the market. The market just seems to move when you least expect it. And what's driving the market, and Vince can talk about this too, is that you have a lot more derivative paper money options. The ETFs over in London, they call ETCs, electronic trade commodity contracts, that are coming in. Asia that's buying consistently. You have more than just simply retail. And what I've been saying back a couple of years ago, when I was warning people about the high premiums and, you know, the risks of spreads, you know, meaning between what you buy it for, what you sell it for, and what the premium could turn to a discount, which wasn't really being factored in by dealers, and they certainly weren't disclosing and providing transparency to that. I kind of explained it as akin to basically trying to run the lumber market by buying 2x4s at Home Depot. You just, the retail market can't it can only lift so much. And as we're seeing here, the retail market, which has been really disengaged, hasn't been the primary factor here. In fact, you know, you look at a lot of these, you know, bigger dealers that use hedging programs and so forth, you know, they're running into the same spots that the miners back in the 2000s and 2010s were running into, where they were hedging production. The prices would start to go north on them, and all of a sudden those hedges became underwater and became almost like a albatross around their neck, because they had to pony up more money because they were getting margin calls on their hedges, but they couldn't release the hedges because, you know, they were basically on lines of credit, or, you know, part of the money, the capitalization that they got required them to have some covenances of protecting the inventory, or the price risk, I should say, so forced them to be hedged. And all of a sudden those hedges became just an ungodly expense. And you could be seeing the same thing happen here in the dealer industry, because the dealer industry, the guys that are hedged, of course, you just had this hike in margin requirements was a 6.5% roughly on gold, and about 10 or 11%, I think, on silver. You know, that adds to the cost of margin, which means these guys have to pony up more money to maintain their hedge exposure. And so that adds to the risk as well. If these guys can't pony up the money, or they're not moving inventory, they may just dump the physical, close out the hedge, and then come back for another day. There are things that happen in the markets for reasons. It's not all just simply everything's manipulated and controlled. I mean, there's, you know, well, certain events get set up.
That's exactly what I wanted to kind of go through a little bit, Bob. Explain a little bit more about where these premiums were raised and what that actually means. And if it's malicious, you know, if it's part of the cartel, all of that, please.
You're saying premiums. Are you saying the margin requirements?
Yeah, the margin.
Yeah. That basically the CME, which controls that. And in reality, the clearing firms can increase their margin rates over and above what the CME requires. But a lot of times they do that when you have a big price move. The CME and Jim can talk about this as well, is they use that to sort of help stabilize the market, you know, in terms of volatility. You know, when prices start to go up in rather higher fashion, it's easy, or it's customary that you see people sort of pile on, and, you know, with that low margin, they can just increase the size of their contracts, which can create instability in the futures markets, not necessarily in the spot market, but you just see more price volatility. And so the way to try to tighten that up is to say, listen, let's raise the margin requirements to make it a little bit more costly just to maintain your contract, where you're not heavily exposed. If the prices get really volatile, all of a sudden the clearing firm, you can blow through margin call territories and be underwater very quickly. They try to control that a little bit. It's very common. It's just where it gets frustrating is like in 2011, where they hammered the silver contract. I think it was 5 or 7 times they raised the margin requirements and just, you know, bludgeoned the price, you know, into the ground. That starts to become questionable. But when you see outsized moves like they've just had, it's common. And actually, the funny thing is it'll strengthen the market. If the market's the underlying tone of the market is strong, less margin or less leverage that's out there won't be as susceptible to maybe a broader market pullback. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Basel III coming into the equation a couple of years ago, the market got delevered. And so, you know, the big swings when you get in the general markets may not impact the physical metals markets as much as it did maybe back in 2008, because there's just a lot less open interest in contracts outstanding.
Jim, do you want to add anything there?
I think Bob calls it pretty good. The only thing I would add is that there's no malicious intent done by the CME that owns these exchanges, the COMEX. It's a volatility adjustment. When you go up or down in a short period of time, the margins almost have to increase, because the margin is what facilitates the winning trade getting paid from the losing side. At the end of every day, Tom, that money transfers from the losing side to the winning side while we're sleeping, basically. So if you've got a $1 move up in silver, that's a big move. That's a $5,000 move on a one silver contract. The margin was just before that Bob's alluding to it, the margin was just a little under 10,000. It was like 98.50 before. And at our clearing firm, it went to a little over 10,000. It's 10,450. So it wasn't a huge, huge one like Bob relates to what happened in history, where sometimes margins could double, that kind of thing. But it's almost a necessity. And I will add that margins do go down, too, when volatility warrants or lack of volatility warrants is what I'd say.
Vince, do you have anything, you know, from the market maker perspective to add to that?
Look, Bob touched on a lot of topics there, right? Topics within the main topic. So if there's something that people want to focus on that he touched on, I mean, he touched on the different cohorts that are in the market. So you've got institutional investors, you've got retail. And by retail, I mean not us, not this group. This group is basically stackers and relatively small to intermediate traders. Retail is like, you know, there's the retail cohort that's basically doctors and lawyers that don't know anything that are throwing money into it. There's the retail cohort, which is us. That's the CTA group. There's the institutional people. There's the central banks. There's the people worried about the fiscal deficit, you know, and there's the bigger picture, the macro picture, and the micro picture. So all these things like the margin requirements going up, how a dealer, a coin dealer, or a metals dealer deals with those margin requirements, how his collateral may not be fungible with his margin, you know, and how the premiums for coins were high and they came in. Why were they high? Well, during COVID, people were getting stimulus checks. The refiners were basically shut down in Europe. You know, there's all kinds of things that happened, perfect storm-wise. But I would rather just throw it back to you, Tom, and see if there's something that you want to focus on within that, you know, constellation of important topics that Bob brought up and Jim elaborated on, that maybe any or all three of us could, you know, take it and run with it, whether it be a question by the audience or a question by you.
We can cover a couple topics here. I've got a couple questions that were submitted ahead of time, so we can cover those before we open up the floor. I just like to keep, you know, a little bit of a tight leash on things because I don't want it to get too chaotic and crazy here. But
But to be fair, I totally get that. But I think, you know, I can go take I can go down a rabbit hole with several topics, and I don't want to do that until I know what people want to hear.
I'll start by asking a question, Vince. Sure. You know, I'm fortunate enough to get your work, read a good amount of your emails, keep up as much as I can. You know, obviously I get a lot of material sent my way, just from the reams of data that you send out, which is very impressive. I've complimented you on that many times. But
you called it a fire hose. I never forgot that. But it's true. Yeah, it's too much sometimes.
Well, you know, to that point, the last email you sent out this afternoon that I got when I got back from my ride today was, it says a whole lot of analysis.
This is
many different banks that are now bullish gold, Bitcoin, copper. I'm sure silver's in there somewhere.
I didn't send that one out yet.
when we see banks starting to change their tune like this, and not just like one or two banks, this is like 5-10 banks, big banks. Right. Does that start to worry you that all of a sudden everybody's starting to see this trade?
Yeah.
And Bob and Jim, feel free to weigh in here as well.
Yeah, that's probably where we are right now. Anyone who has exposure to precious metals is probably saying, it's kind of like the W.C. Fields thing. Do I want to be a member of any club that'll have me, type of thing? And, it's kind of like a semiotic square. You know, it's kind of like there's the good, bad, bad, good. You know, there's a decision table here. And what I think I would like to just give you that, I think, in a nutshell. But before I do, this group, right, this Twitter or X or whatever it's called now, this group of professionals and investors, speculators and day traders, it's hard to believe this, but we're not the public anymore. We're as well-informed as any investor with an account at Goldman Sachs. And some people are as informed as institutional traders that understand the plumbing of it. So the reason I bring that up is because 3 years ago, we would have been going, what did Kitco say? And that's nothing against Kitco. Or we'd be like, what did CNBC say about gold? Or we'd be hanging on every word that came out. Oh, did you know that so-and-so said gold could go up this year? Circulate amongst your gold and silver bug friends, and probably the Bitcoin guys too, before it got a lot of press. And during that time, we were just starved for information. And by the time we heard you should buy gold, it was on CNBC, we rolled our eyes and said, oh shit, this is it, it's done, you know? Because how many times had we gotten burned? And then, you know, the rhetoric slams higher and higher, gold's going to 5,000, gold's going to 10,000, all that other, you know, nonsense. Anyway, but now, you know, and this is kind of a social media thing, the decentralization of information has allowed this group here in particular. You know, I have to say that the people on Twitter that I interact with, whether they be listening to what I say or I be listening to what they say, we're better informed than 90% of the industry now, not just we're 99.9% of the people in the world, but 90% of the industry. So that preface done, what I'm trying to say is, to your question now, there are two types of banks. There's the bullion banks and there are the other banks. Now, the bullion banks are the, you know, the Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, et cetera, those people that are on the LBMA and are big players. And then there's the other banks. And the other banks, I'll just say, it's every other bank, your data firms, plus your independent research firms. So it's the smaller banks, the Bloombergs, the BCAs, you know, the Jeffrey Christians, things like that. Those are the analytical firms that'll go on YouTube or something like that. So those two, so forget the other banks, right? Let's just stay with the bullion banks, because that's, everyone takes their lead from them that you care about, at least that I care about. Historically, the bullion banks do one of two things. They have a personality. This is going to help everyone filter what's nonsense and what's not. The bullion banks have one of two ways of handling things. One, they sell it hard, meaning they give you the pitch. Gold's going to 5,000, and they'll do that on occasion. You hear things like super cycle. And then there's the other type of bank the other bullion bank style is they downplay everything. So I'm going to name two banks for you here and their styles, and I'm not judging their styles. Their styles exist for a reason. Goldman Sachs is the bank that trades to make money. Okay, so they have their finger on the pulse. And if they think something is susceptible for a rally for any reason at all, too many people are short, the fundamentals, you'll hear that a lot. The fundamentals, you hear that in oil, geopolitical, anything that they believe can make the market go higher, they will position themselves for it. They'll nibble, they'll start to get long, then they'll put out feelers. And after the feelers are put out, then the reports will come. Now, there's within Goldman Sachs, there are two types of research. There's probably three types, but I see two. One type is what's called the sell side research, right? That's the research you give to your clients. And it's genuine when they're talking about explaining how things operate, explaining how things work, right? But that research typically is just one step better than the, you know, talking head on CNBC going, gold's going up, I think we should buy it. But, you know, it's intellectual, but it's still a sales marketing research piece, right? And those reports before recently would just come out on occasion when Goldman said, okay, I think there's a little bit of a rally here. We're long. We'll put a report out. Their clients will buy it. And then they would see how it acted. They'd either ride with their clients or they'd sell to their clients. Now, I don't say that negatively. That's just the way it is. That's Goldman Sachs. So that's not just Goldman Sachs, but that's how Goldman operates. There's really not a lot of money to be made in precious metals, period, until recently. And what I mean is on the sales side, on the trading side, there's plenty of money. And Goldman masters the trading side. Now, within Goldman, they have the traders, and the traders will put out their own small private reports that I happen to get very frequently. And those reports, you have to know how to read them. You know, you have to have been burned by these over the years. So when the marketing report comes out and it says we think gold has an upside. You know, the end of the year report, December 23 report, gold's going up and here's why. Well, that's the Christmas present report. That's the fundamental analysis report that also sets the table for what I call buy season. You know, the January effect. We're seeing some buying player in these markets, massive. But Citibank does not say shit. If you even post Citibank says it's going up, you get a cease and desist letter. Like that's how they operate. And you may think they're like they're amateur or they're just retail, you know, because of the whole Citibank. You know, it just looks like they're cheesy. But on the bullion side, they have massive institutional customer business, producers, end users, countries that buy. So they keep their research out of the limelight. Okay. So you don't see research from Citibank or JP Morgan, not historically, Citibank or JP Morgan. You see research from Goldman Sachs, Standard Charter, you know, and then you have HSBC, which kind of falls in the middle. But then you've got UBS, and UBS, you know, they're, I like UBS a lot. They're very professional because they do have legitimate buyers. Anyway, so those are how the banks operate. And that's how I look at it in a nutshell forever, you know, and that's from getting burned so many times. But here's what's different now. When the market started running up before that December 3rd spike, the banks had nothing to say. None of those banks had anything to say. Not the trading desk, you know, those trading special reports I get, and not the regular sales pieces, okay? Now, that's either because they don't know what's going on, and believe me, they know what's going on, or because they actually were handling the orders for the clients. So it's you don't talk about what you're doing when you're buying for a big client. You talk about it afterwards, all right? So a big client, a player, a central bank is what I'm getting at, that type, right? A sovereign wealth fund. Then after the December 3rd spike, December 4th spike, that spike we had up, and it's like, oh my God, what's going on at the end of the world stuff? And then the market, if you look at the market, if you're looking at a chart from December 4th to March 1st, the market had big ranges, but it was sideways to lower. And during that time, no one said shit. You would hear the occasion, why is gold up? We don't know. I'm like, what do you mean you don't know? Of course you know. You know, like you started seeing these things like that. And then after 3 months from December 3rd to March 1st, the market stops acting like that and explodes. And as it's exploding in the first week of explosion, the banks with their research, they come out and say, and this is the advice, right? They come out and say, well, geez, like Goldman Sachs, it's a mystery. Why is it rallying? You know, Bank of America. Yeah, gold's telling us that we should be worried about stocks. Okay, what's gold telling us about gold? You know, and all these banks started talking about gold and not silver yet in a peripheral sort of way. Like, you know, hey, gold going up might be, it won't last long because of correlations, because of yields. But the behavior was different. It's all of a sudden like, you know, I don't know what's going on. You know, it's like a hitman. I don't know why you're going to get shot in the back of the head when you walk into the room like Joe Pesci or something. But that's right. So now we go into the second week in March, and now it's starting to rip more. And I'm like, okay, when are the recommendations coming? Because I'm thinking, right, old school jaded. I'm like, oh, well, the recommendations are going to come out. Goldman Sachs is going to say gold $3,000. Let's sell it, you know, to the Muppets. Didn't happen. And CNBC starts talking about it. Now they're saying, we don't know. It's a mystery. Now they start talking about silver and it's going up. And then all the bullion banks start coming out with reports again. Okay. Mm-hmm. So UBS, being honest, we love it. We're raising our target. We think you're crazy to buy it right now. That's what they said. That's mm-hmm. honest, right? Right. Citibank. These are honest reports. Citibank. We love it. We're raising our target, but we're not going to buy it until there's a pullback for clients. That's another, even if they're wrong, it's at least honest. They're not going, it's going to $3,000, you know, Goldman Sachs, boo. They don't say boo, right? And that's probably because they want to say it's going to $3,000, but they don't say boo about it. It's just, you know, me taking inventory of the guys of the stuff that I see. And I'm looking at all this going, why are they giving these such professional dry reports? And I talked to a guy on a desk. He goes, listen, everyone's talking about gold. Okay. If you're not talking about gold, your client's like, what are you, stupid? Do you not see what's mm-hmm. going on? So they have to talk about it, but they're handling order flow. Now, and this is the last couple of days, now I'm seeing another round of reports come out. And those round of reports are not coming from the banks anymore. They're coming from TV again. You know, it's like, you know, correlations are breaking. Everyone's talking about stuff that we talked about, that Bob and I and Jim probably as well talked about for months. The correlations are breaking down. The debt, it's like, you know, it's become a story. Anyway, short story long, right? Long story short. Historically, we as a group of investors are used to being the mushrooms, you know, in a room with the windows painted black and fed a lot of shit. And so when it comes on CNBC, right, we're like, oh, here we go. It must be the top, you know, and that behavior is still there. If you just look at CNBC and those type of venues, they're talking about it now. That's dangerous, right? And if you look at the banks said boo. They didn't say anything from December after a new all-time high, you know, from December to March. They said zero. And I think this is me saying out loud, I think they were handling massive. And once they were filled, they were allowed to say something. But I think that their institutional clients started to buy first. That's in March. That's the stuff that Bob alluded to, right? Started rotating higher. Institutions came in. All of a sudden, the hedge funds are long, right? All of a sudden, the CTAs are long. All of a sudden, everybody likes gold and they're buying strength. It's no longer behaving, you know? So now we're at a point where I think, you know, handicapping a little bit. Now we're at a point where it's in the short term, we're overbought. How's that? It's in everyone's awareness, right? Costco is selling gold bars. That's real. That's not bullshit. That's a business. Costco's like, mm-hmm. hey, we can make some money off of this. I'll do it, right? And that's probably, you know, another refiner or a dealer who's got some overhang saying, I'd love to. And Bob can answer that, you know, PAMP or Atmex or whoever. But, you know, when you put all that together, short term, if you were looking short term, and I'm not advising you to trade the short term, this market has now reached a critical mass where I'm getting the World Gold Council saying, gold is great. I'm like, well, yeah, well, where were you fucking $500 ago? You know, like, you know, and that's it. That's all you need to know. Where were you $500 ago? Anyway, so, mm-hmm. so, but long term, these things, and I say this sincerely, the banks, the bullion banks we're talking about, are no longer dictating direction. They're reacting to direction. And little by little, they're being forced to talk about it more, even when they don't want to. I think they might be a little mm-hmm. bit too short right now. Anyway, that's it. I think overbought short term, speaking as a trader, but all this information that you're getting, guys, this is grassroots. This is the world built, coming to think like we do. You know, it's like, oh yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll get some physical. Maybe I'll buy something from Costco. Maybe I'll take a 1,000 ounce silver bar instead of, you know, a couple coins. And there you have it. We are in a, what do they call it? A sea change, a zeitgeist. It's happening. It's real. And we can go through all the reasons that's happening, but it's real. But right now I'm like, Jesus, I just got 5 reports. I'm like, what are they trying to tell me? Anyway, so that's it. That's my take on the bank analysis whether to believe it or not. Right now, I don't believe it. How's that?
Well, it's interesting how that all ends up adding up and adding together, right? And then somebody with your experience, Vince, you almost have to take each report on its own and know how to read each one. But I think this is a perfect question or a perfect time to jump in with a question from Silver Raider that asked, when do you guys think that retail will get back in and help to drive premiums back up?
Can I help with that initially, at least?
Yeah, absolutely. And Bob as well.
What I've seen, or what we've all seen, is that 3 or 4 years back, a new universe of investors came into the silver market. And they had this acronym WSS or Reddit, REDDIT, and I'm not going to, belabor anything other than they help 100,000 to 130,000 people get exposed to silver, very much retail, okay? Mm-hmm. That's 3-4 years ago. Now what I'm seeing is that just in the last probably 2-3 months, Tom, that I've been hearing that Costco has been selling, we all know, gold. And they're not just selling it, they're running out of it sometimes. And yep. They're exposing a whole new universe of retail buyers. This time it's gold, probably silver. It's too small a price item for them to deal with. But retail is all about dollars per square foot. And it doesn't take many square feet to have a counter analogous to a jewelry counter, a small jewelry counter, to be retailing gold out of a Costco store. All right. So that's a little bit of the retail side. If I can just go back in support of what Vince was saying, what has made a big impact on me has been certainly the charts. We all watch them. But since March, the first trading day of March, we probably haven't seen these bullion banks like Vince was mentioning selling into this rally. And if we would have, we wouldn't have had since March 1st, I just calculated while I was listening to Vince, 14.4% increase in futures on gold and 26%, almost double in silver.
That's right.
And that's just mathematics, that the low price things can go up a lot quicker than the higher price things. But that is a big move from 2260 to 2860. Yesterday and today, we hit 2860 in the front month May futures. Now, the listeners on the board, they don't really care when I talk about futures, but the price of futures can, in fact, help dictate or help set the price of their Silver Eagles or their, Canadian Maple Leafs, whatever they're interested in, or their bars. But we've had big, big moves. And I think that what is behind the big, big moves in support of Vince's premise is that this is not a retail move. This might be, Tom, this might be institutions. It might be bullion banks. If they're allocating capital to the long side, or more importantly, there's a well-known silver analyst that's been covering silver since 1980s. Everybody knows who it is. He was saying, if they don't sell into this move, maybe we can keep going. And that's, we don't have evidence. Today was a little down day.
Who's they, Jim? Who's they that needs to sell into this move before it keeps
they
going?
Meaning the bullion banks. Maybe Vince okay. talking about, and they're doing it. The bullion banks are doing it because they have a trading desk, Tom, with people staffed like you and I and some women there. And their whole goal is to make money every single day.
If they trade
100 or 1,000 contracts a day and they make $3 on gold, that's $300 times 3,000 contracts.
All right. Can I jump in for a second? Because
go ahead, Vince.
Because what Jim is saying is spot on. And I'm going to put a little color that ties with Bob said about the institutional buying, that ties with Jim said about the banks, and that ties with the behavioral change in March. And here it is. In the institutions, and just so everyone knows, institution means large hedge funds. That would be what we call frequently global macro discretionary. Now, these are not retail guys that buy strength. These are not small mom and pop hedge funds. These are not, big retail customers. These are the Paul Tudor Joneses. These are the guys that trade billions of dollars in bonds. Now, these guys don't trade gold typically. They trade everything else because guess what? Everything else moves, right? So over the years, they've ignored gold. I'm going to paint this so you really see what's going on. It's fascinating because I had to put it all together. Okay, so typically what these big macro institutional traders do, and they're global, they're not just American. They will say, where's gold? Oh, screw it, right? When gold makes a new high, call me. And when it makes a new high, like it did on December 3rd, they buy it. Now, what they bought on December 3rd was, again, this is gold, right? So everyone's a little gun shy. They bought calls. Now, the reason that's important is because of what happened on March 1st. They bought calls and the market got tamped down for whatever reason it did. And it went sideways and those calls got crushed. And you actually saw the volatility get annihilated. Now, March 1st comes and I don't know what caused it, but it was the beginning of the month. And macro discretionary likes to come in on new months. Whatever the reason, they started to buy. Now, Jim says correctly that there wasn't a lot of selling by the bullion banks. How does he know that? He knows that because we went up 14%, right? As he says, the math. We went up 26%. That's right. And bullion banks will not sell if they don't have the bullets. Now, they usually have the bullets. But this is what made this especially interesting. See, the macro discretionary global guys, they saw options volatility had been crushed over months and they bought options. This is about what's called, you know, a gamma squeeze if you're a zero hedge fan. So the macro discretionary guys said, you know what? The first group said, fuck it. I'm not going to buy futures. I'm going to buy options. In the gold options market, I was a gold options market maker. And as a gold options market maker, I would be the guy who would handle calls, trades with those guys. But most of that business was done by the banks. So the macro discretionary guy calls up his bank and says, hey, make me a market in the 2100 call. The bank has to make the market. I mean, morally he does, otherwise he loses the customer. So the banks kept selling calls. And the institutional hedge funds kept buying it. Now, normally the banks don't care because they're bigger than the players. But for the month of March, as the buying of futures came in after the calls were bought, what you saw was the banks, the bullion banks, I'm not saying they're going under, but this is a little bit of bullion bank porn for everyone here. As the market rallied, right, the guys that were long the calls, they did nothing. They just got longer. This time they were trapped in their own Roach Motel. They could not get out, you know? And so when Bob says the dealers, he's talking about the metals dealers, but he also is talking about, believe it or not, the bullion banks, they're dealers. And when Jim says 14%, 26%, well, there's a reason for that, right? And the reason is, as he said, the banks are still selling, but not as aggressively as before. They're not bullying the market anymore. So this is what's going on. The bullion banks, I'm not saying they're losing money, but how many are there? Six, five of those five banks? I can almost guarantee you one of them is losing money. The other four may be making money. So out of the five, you know, JP Morgan, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, they're all making money, you know. But one of those banks, maybe HSBC, maybe Standard Charter, they're losing money because they're like, oh shit, I didn't know this. So they put their B team on these metals desks now. Anyway, so the banks were caught flat-footed. And they may regain their footing, but they did not get in the way of this, which is, again, tying together what everyone else has said, but adding to it, the market is different now. It could drop $300 and the market will still be different. Anyway, hope that helps.
Vince, do they want, you know, more volatility in the metals for it to be a market that they want to trade? Like, not necessarily that it needs to make a new high, but is it also just that they want some volatility there that they can trade and be able to make some of that spread?
You mean when you say they, you mean the bank dealers or you mean the customers?
The bullion banks.
Okay. The bullion banks.
Sorry, just to add a little bit more color there. Yeah. It's almost like especially over, let's say, over the past 3 years, you know, we've had these months where the gold price doesn't change more than $100.
Right.
And
right.
if there's no volatility up or down, that makes a really boring instrument for these guys to be trading.
No, that's you know, the point. A busy market that goes nowhere, you know, a noise to signal ratio, right? Oh, the market's been great for a market maker. It's been, you know, in a $50 range, but it's unchanged on the month. That's what they like to see. Now, the other thing that makes them, unfortunately, not happy with this volatility that we have now is they got lifted on options. And I want to just paint this picture that normally they can bully the market where they want to, well, you know, because they just have the flows. But right now, every option, this is why they don't want volatility at all right now. Right now, every option they're short is in the money. So all those 2,100 calls and 2,000 calls that they're short, they have been buying, this is the point of the negative gamma, why they don't want volatility now. They have been buying futures on the way up to mitigate losses. If the market goes back down to 1900, they're going to lose money. They're going to lose money because then they're going to have to sell futures into weakness. So right now, they don't want even intraday volatility. They want this market to go sideways, and they don't want any more news bomb surprises coming out. But normally, you're right, they want volatility. But right now, they're too short. That's it. They have too much exposure.
To your point there, Vince, AC Motorman was saying, what are you guys talking about? The swap dealers are more short than they've been in 4 years in the face of a 30% rise. So does that jive with what you're seeing?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that directly. What are we talking about? Hi, this is what we're talking about. If you're a bank and you're a federally insured bank, you borrow at whatever, 5% now, right? And so you can afford to be short gold. Gold is, in terms of the big money, gold's a pimple on their ass. Now, I'm not saying they don't lose money. What I'm saying is they can be short longer than most people can be long. So the banks are the poker players at the table with unlimited money at 5%, whereas most people are borrowing at 20% off of their credit cards. So the banks can be short and just keep bluffing and just keep raising the ante until they finally get paired pocket aces, and then they could slam it. So yes, they have been short, but they've also been shorter. But the thing is, it's not how short they are that matters. It's how much negative gamma they have. So the banks live on the short side historically because most of their business was producer based. So if I know I've got a producer who's going to hedge production in 30 days, I'm going to get short. I'm going to front run my own business. That's the model, right? Producers aren't hedging anymore. So the banks are still doing their old modus operandi. Oh, I think I'll play from the short side. Somebody will sell it eventually, right? But no one is selling it. So now going back to the banks again, the banks don't go under from paper shorts. The traders at banks go under. So you're at a bank, you've got a desk, you've got two traders on it. One guy is short 20,000 contracts. One guy is short 30,000 contracts. The guy who's short 30,000 contracts is up $5 million in the last 6 months because he trades around the position. The guy who's short 20,000 contracts is 23 years old, just out of college, and doesn't know what he's doing. He's just copying the guy on his desk. Well, the bank doesn't blow up. The trader blows up. So what makes a bank cover his shorts is not the bank on the paper side. It's the trader who's getting liquidated. So that's why they're short. They're always short. They can get shorter, but more important than being short paper right now is being short options and refusing to make delivery at expiration, which they did last week. So they're genetically short, but that's changing. They're being basically they're running into someone bigger than them. And you know, no hedge fund is bigger than a bank, but when 20 of them buy at the same time, you can be short if you're a bank, but you still want to make money and they have to sell at better levels.
How does that condition get resolved? The price comes back down, they pair that short, and then everybody keeps buying? Or how does that end up resolving itself?
Oh, mechanically, if I'm a bank trader on the desk, I'll give you the tactical thing right now. There are guys out there, I don't know his name, but Metals Daily, they're saying that when the options expire, the market will calm down and go down. Well, that may or may not be true. But the reality of it is, if I'm a bank trader and I'm in that Roach Motel, who am I going to buy those options back from? If I can't get those options back, you know, I'm basically biting my nails for the next 30 days. When those options expire, then maybe I can reassert my strength. And if the market just drops for different reasons, you could see the Bank of International Settlements say, here's some metal, go have fun, and then they can start front running the plays again. But the bottom line is if this is a real market, and I believe it is, you're going to see cycles now. The option guys, the macro guys buy it, dealers get short, the market runs up, the macro guys start to liquidate, the dealers smell blood, they start to push it down, the options expire, you know, rinse, lather, repeat. So we're in a cyclical type of situation right now. But I won't pretend to know how it resolves itself until the next month or so goes by.
To your point there, Vince, AC Motorman was saying, what are you guys talking about? The swap dealers are more short than they've been in 4 years in the face of a 30% rise. So does that jive with what you're seeing?
Yeah, I'm going to answer that directly. What are we talking about? Hi, this is what we're talking about. If you're a bank and you're a federally insured bank, you borrow at whatever, 5% now, right? And so you can afford to be short gold. Gold is, in terms of the big money, gold's a pimple on their ass. Now, I'm not saying they don't lose money. What I'm saying is they can be short longer than most people can be long. So the banks are the poker players at the table with unlimited money at 5%, whereas most people are borrowing at 20% off of their credit cards. So the banks can be short and just keep bluffing and just keep raising the ante until they finally get paired pocket aces, and then they could slam it. So yes, they have been short, but they've also been shorter. But the thing is, it's not how short they are that matters. It's how much negative gamma they have. So long story short, the banks live on the short side historically because most of their business was producer-based. So if I know I've got a producer who's going to hedge production in 30 days, I'm going to get short. I'm going to front run my own business. That's the model, right? Producers aren't hedging anymore. So the banks are still doing their old modus operandi. Oh, I think I'll play from the short side. Somebody will sell it eventually, right? But no one is selling it. Now, going back to the banks again, the banks don't go under from paper shorts. The traders at banks go under. So you're at a bank, you've got a desk, you've got two traders on it. One guy is short 20,000 contracts. One guy is short 30,000 contracts. The guy who's short 30,000 contracts is up $5 million in the last 6 months because he trades around the position. The guy who's short 20,000 contracts is 23 years old, just out of college, and doesn't know what he's doing. He's just copying the guy on his desk. Well, the bank doesn't blow up. The trader blows up. So what makes a bank cover his shorts is not the bank on the paper side. It's the trader who's getting liquidated. So that's why they're short. They're always short. They can get shorter. But more important than being short paper right now is being short options and refusing to make delivery at expiration, which they did last week. So they're genetically short, but that's changing. So they're being basically they're being run into. They're running into someone bigger than them. And, you know, no hedge fund is bigger than a bank. But when 20 of them buy at the same time, you know, you can be short if you're a bank, but you still want to make money. And they have to sell at better levels.
So how does that condition get resolved? The price comes back down, they pair that short, and then everybody keeps buying? Or how does that end up resolving itself?
Oh, mechanical. I'll give you the tactical thing right now. There are guys out there, I don't know his name, but Metals Daily, they're saying that when the options expire, the market will calm down and go down. Well, that may or may not be true. But the reality of it is, if I'm a bank trader and I'm in that Roach Motel, who am I going to buy those options back from? If I can't get those options back, you know, I'm basically biting my nails for the next 30 days. When those options expire, then maybe I can reassert my strength. And if the market just drops for different reasons, you could see the Bank of International Settlements say, here's some metal, go have fun. And then they can start front running the plays again. But the bottom line is if this is a real market, and I believe it is, you're going to see cycles now. So the option guys, but the macro guys buy it. Dealers get short. The market runs up. The macro guys start to liquidate. The dealers smell blood. They start to push it down. The options expire. You know, rinse, lather, repeat. So we're in a cyclical type of situation right now. But I won't pretend to know how it resolves itself until the next month or so goes by.
Bob, anything to add there?
Well, last October, we did a, I don't know if it was a Spaces or an interview where I talked about how a lot of the refineries trading desks were looking to go long vol, gold vol, for example, because you had gold volatility, basically, I think it was in October of last year, back down to near all-time low or near majorly multi-year low levels. And so from a trading perspective, they would use options to various paired trades to take advantage of that low volatility, basically to get long vol. And so they would actually profit from the increase in volatility. Whether or not the prices of metals go up and down is immaterial. I mean, the big thing is using options and the pricing models to make money on the vol side. But typically, what's interesting is really since October, when gold vol goes up, that's usually indicative of gold prices going up as well. We kind of saw that sort of pattern sort of develop after the lows were hit in October. You have certain trading desks that are, whether they're proprietary trading, but they're making markets or making investments in markets that are accentuating their profits. It's kind of like they used to be, and Vince probably could mention, like the proprietary trading desks, prop desks of back in the 2000s, 1990s. That's one thing. But what's to get more to what we're seeing today, there, I had a chance to talk to one institutional firm, and they made an interesting a point is that what they were seeing basically in mid-March when gold started taking off and institutions that were selling gold back at 1900 or those institutions weren't chasing the market. They missed the move completely. And so what you started to see happen in mid-March was some allocations into silver as the surrogate for gold. And that's where you started to see some rather big contributions into the European physical silver funds. I think it was WisdomTree, as well as iShares physical fund out of Ireland. But WisdomTree happened to have, it was like over $500 billion worth of money flow come in on one day, it happened to be the largest trade of the entire day in all of Europeans markets. I mean, so you have institutions that are saying, I'm not going to chase gold here and look at silver. It's gold silver ratio was 89, 90 to one, whatever it was. You have a market that's half of where it was back at its highs in 2011, 1980. You can make those types of comparisons. But what they're looking at is anything, if we're in an inflationary type of environment or a melt up, so to speak, in asset prices, this is where you start to go long pretty much everything that hasn't moved, because obviously a lot of other stuff is already at new highs or you had Bitcoin go through the roof, with the Bitcoin ETF and that type of thing. So and then you had, the issues with silver, the cost of production sitting around $22, $23 an ounce. Most primary silver producers not making any money. And then in fact, most of their production or majority of their production is now gold. So silver is really more of a byproduct of other metals. And you had base metals that were down and out as well. So you probably saw less byproduct production coming into the market. Well, that almost had to have some type of, and on top of all that, you had sentiment in the toilet. People were just completely distraught on mining stocks. I mean, the comments that I was seeing out there a month and a half ago were just, people, it's like you'd wipe the certificates with your ass. It's worth more as toilet paper than it was worth more than the stock certificate in a lot of issues. But the setup was there for the market to catch a bid, whether it would be the refinery desks and other trading desks looking to take advantage of a very low gold vol, whether it's, you had, and I documented this, I've been kind of talking about this really since February, mid-February, when I talked about this mother of all squeezes that I could see coming, because the setup on the CTAs back in mid to late February was, they were $1 billion short notional value of silver. I mean, it only happened, 5% of the time, going back to the history of the COT, the Commitment of Traders reports, you had very one-sided positioning there. And so you had this sort of perfect sort of storm. And then you lay on top of that the fundamentals with the election coming up and the spending $1 trillion in 100 days. And it doesn't take a lot. The kindling was dry. It just needed a match. And that's what we kind of saw here. And then all of a sudden, kind of like what Vince was saying, you had this sort of fire start to spread and go uphill, and it just happens to go uphill very fast. The question now, I think that a lot of people are saying is, okay, where are we at right now? Are we, we're overbought. Does this thing pull back? Does it hold here? Does it consolidate? Or are there players that are actually in trouble that are on the short side that, it can't take the pain? And that's what I'm trying to show on this short volume, these short volume charts that I kind of pull up every day. And I continue to see, as a lot of volume comes into the SLV, for example, you're just seeing an increasing amount of short volume activity. And that's, a lot of that's, market makers or institutional type of traders dealing in the market. What I kind of see is this idea that if you look at SLV, for example, and you look at March 1st to April 1st, we got the numbers for short interest activity right now through mid-March, and it literally doubled from 15 million ounces or 15 million shares short to 30 million shares short. You saw, an obvious increase in short volume sales or short volume selling activity in March in general. What you're seeing is, and most people would say, well, the short volume, there's two sides to the equation. There's the initial short where, for example, the market maker is trying to make a market. They're the ones who are selling when people are buying. And so their idea is they will sell you on the offer side, looking to buy back on the bid side, make money on the spread. And traditionally that works until you get into a one-sided market. And this is where a lot of this sort of management of the market that I've talked about the last couple of years comes into play. By them shorting, they can go naked short. It's within the rules. But by them shorting into the flows of the market, they act as a sort of a sponge in a way. And so it tends to slow down. Like in the ETFs, for example, the short interest was growing. But if you look at the shares outstanding from March 1st to April 1st, they did not change one share. Literally, it was nothing had changed. There wasn't, you would think silver going up 10% in a month or whatever, you'd see a lot more shares outstanding, a lot more interest, and then obviously a lot more, as more interest comes in, the authorized participants to meet that interest would create more shares, and so you wouldn't have any disparities with regard to big discounts and premiums to the net asset value. They'd actually use creation and redemption of shares.
Bob, is that reflective of basically nobody buying new SLV shares and just that lack of interest, not only in the physical side from retail, but also in the ETFs?
Well, what's interesting is you can make an argument that the ETF flows were being met by short selling as a way to absorb that flow instead of share creation. Meaning, for example, if you have a lot of money coming into a sector, there's arbitrage that they can take advantage of when, for example, the shares become priced at a premium to the underlying asset that ETF represents. So what happens basically is the authorized participant in silver's case can take silver that they may have in inventory or they may go out to the market to get, and they may deliver that to the ETF if the shares are trading at a premium, because basically they're exchanging their underlying silver for more expensive shares that they can sell into the market and garner that spread, that arbitrage profit from. And just like on the vice versa, if you see a lot of selling in the market, they can come in and buy one of those shares at a big discount, because then they can go and redeem those shares, those cheaper shares, for the underlying silver and make money on the arbitrage that way too. There's activities that obviously benefit authorized participants, and that helps them make a market for the ETFs that they make markets for. But what's happening though is, you would think with all this price activity and flow that you'd be seeing just more interest in the ETFs in general. And you saw this, you can't say it didn't happen, because you saw it happen in the European ETF, the ETCs they call them, but it happened over there where you had WisdomTree's fund literally jump 50% in shares outstanding or metals held in the fund, 50% almost in one day. I mean, those are huge moves. And to say that SLV is not seeing any interest at all, but the short interest is going up, the short selling volume is jumping rather dramatically. The question you have to ask yourself is, are dealers or market makers meeting the demand by just simply shorting shares? Now, the market makers, they could be long in other areas, so they could be, those could be hedge transactions. You know, we don't know. That's the problem. Obviously, we're not the fly on the wall in these trading rooms. It'd be nice to, because then we kind of know exactly what the real positioning is. But that's what I'm trying to identify here, is that there has been potentially a lot of flow coming into the market, but it's been matched by short selling, not necessarily by simply authorized participants going to the market, getting silver, delivering the silver to the fund and creating those shares. Now, and then you have to ask yourself, well, why is that the case? And then you look at India and the buying out of China, and you see the physical demand for those 1,000-ounce silver bars. You're talking a lot of silver was bought by India the first 2 months of this year. You can make a very solid case that, okay, was it very difficult to actually get the silver? And this is what we're sort of seeing, is this sort of cloak and dagger type of thing, that they're kind of hiding the sensitivity of maybe how tight the silver market is. Because this is one thing that I was talking about in February, late February, when you did the roll out of March contract and silver going into May contract, I think it is, you had the exchange for physical premium basically go nowhere. It was like stuck in time. It didn't drop in premium, which normally the exchange for physical premium, it's basically a spread trade between London spot and the New York lead month contract. Typically, the lead month contract, as you get closer and closer to expiration, you have that time decay in value. So the contract spread tends to naturally go to zero as you get closer to expiration. Well, that wasn't happening. Somebody was caught short, or was shorting the market and was continually selling potentially, and then all of a sudden had to start buying either futures contracts or lifting. It was somehow artificially lifting the leg of that EFP up at a time when it should have been naturally declining. And when it's going up in that type of atmosphere, it's usually the futures market portion of the leg that's actually moving up in price rather than the spot market. For example, you know, the spot market really starts moving up in price versus the futures market, you get into a backwardation. But when the futures market starts to surge, that starts to move that EFP more positive.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this piece of the Twitter Spaces that we were able to save. If you want to be a part of the next one, please follow us at Palisades Radio, and we'll have a discussion with more interesting guests in the future that you can be a part of. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.